But I'm going to start with a general premise, and I want to go a little further in explaining Marxism, because literally all critical race theory is, it is rooted in critical theory. Critical theory was a Marxist ideology, and critical theory was really something that's applied to a monetary or an economic position, right? Again, remember in Marxism, there's only two classes of people, the oppressed and the oppressors, and in a financial standpoint, right, the idea was either you have money or you don't have money. And if you don't have money, it's because somebody took your money from you. And if you have money, it's because you took it from somebody else. Well, this theory was applied in the early 1900s in America. And it never lasted and survived because there's too much economic mobility in America. And every single person in this room, no exception, every single person, either you, your parents, your grandparents, or your great-grandparents, no more than four generations, one of them came from dire poverty. And they worked their way up. In America, there's too much economic fluidity and mobility. It doesn't matter where you start in America. Like, the reason people want to come here, the American dream, but this led to Marxist rethinking. And so then in the 1960s, right, then in Harvard, they said, well, what if we look at critical race theory and let's look at a legal standpoint, right? Because maybe the reason that minorities aren't getting ahead is because of the law. Well, even unfolding critical theory or critical race theory at Harvard, what they determined is that really, literally after the civil rights era, right, MLK, the mid-1960s, 1965, after those laws, you could point back to, right, prior to the Civil War, slavery existed. So yes, there was some level of systemic oppression, but slavery wasn't in every colony, not in every state, not everybody was a slave. And then you could go, okay, argue, so, and then some of the Southern Democrat stronghold states, you did have Jim Crow laws, and you did have some of this racist stuff, but then you had the Civil Rights. So literally, since when they started debating this at Harvard, they said, since the Civil Rights era, then the mid-1960s, there is no more, right, legal position where there are not racist laws anymore. However, this position was so ingrained in some people that they're trying to find a way to paint America as bad and evil. And so if you're a Marxist, you always have to have two opposing forces. What's one of the easy ways to do that is, right, it's by gender, it's by race. And so we're actually seeing this unfold. Well, this is part of the foundation that leads to something like the 1619 Project, right? If you remember Nicole Hannah-Jones, in 2019, 400th anniversary, they came out with the 1619 Project, and the premise was that America wasn't founded in 1776. Like, when America became a nation? No, that's not when we really were America, even though that is when we really were America. Nope. She says it was 1619, and this is the opening statement from the 1619 Project. The 1619 Project is a major initiative from the New York Times observing the anniversary of the beginning of American slavery. It aims to reframe the country's history, understanding 1619 as our true founding, and placing the consequences of slavery and the contributions of Black Americans at the very center of the story we tell ourselves about who we are. So, a couple things. Notice they didn't say that we want to be honest and tell the truth. They said we want to reframe. We want to tell a different story. We want to emphasize something else. And also, we want to, the contributions of Black Americans, We want to highlight the contributions of Black Americans, put that at the center of the story. Remember that? We're coming back to that later, right? But on their websites, they actually have articles they encourage teachers to use in their classroom. All I did, literally, was get on their website, and I took a screenshot of the title of some of the articles, like this one. Our democracy's founding ideals were false when they were written. Black Americans have fought to make them true. Okay? First of all, which ideals were false? That we were created equal? That we have God-given rights? That the government exists for... Like, what was false? I'm just curious. Like, what were you thinking? And then, Black Americans have fought to make them true? Oh, there's no doubt that there have been some incredible Black abolitionists along the way. You know who helped them become abolitionists? The white abolitionists. I want you to think for a second. 13th Amendment. What ended slavery in America? How many Black people signed it? None, because there was none in Congress at the time. Or the 14th, or the 15th Amendment. I'm not discounting the contributions of a Frederick Douglass, some of these incredible leaders. However, you are being so dishonest to presume that everybody who's white is racist, and only the black people fought against slavery? Well, that's very dishonest from the very beginning. Let's keep going. Another article. America holds on to an undemocratic assumption from its founding that some people deserve more power than others. No, no, no. All men were created equal. Jefferson really defined that. Let's also be very clear. Okay? Some people deserve more power than others. That's literally the reason we separated from the king. It's the reason the Constitution we wrote, we the people. We don't have a political better. You know what elected officials used to be called? Public servants. Because they work for us. We literally believed in an equality across the board, and yet, that's not what we're teaching kids today, or the idea that sugar that saturates the American diet has a barbaric history as the white gold that killed slavery. I'm not kidding. This is one of the dumbest articles I've ever read, and I've read some dumb ones. This article makes the claim that candy bars are actually part of a white systemic structure of racism because candy actually came from the sugarcane sugar from slave plantations. So if you enjoy a candy bar, it's part of the white systemic power structure and you are supporting racism along the way. I thought I just wanted a Snickers. I didn't know I was a racist. Like, this is crazy, guys. These are articles that kids in high schools all across America are reading, and this is what they're learning. Let's keep going. Most Americans still don't know the full story of slavery. This is the history you didn't learn in school. Now, I agree. Most Americans do not know the full history of slavery. However, what they are teaching is not the honest history of slavery, and how bad the position is in the political climate today. Senator Tim Kaine from Virginia, just a year and a half ago, he said the United States created slavery. We didn't inherit slavery from anybody. Okay, let's pause for a second. Tim Kaine says he is a faithful and practicing Catholic. I'm pretty sure they have Genesis in the Catholic Bible. I'm saying this facetiously. In Genesis, there's a story of this guy named Joseph, right? Coat of many colors. His brother sold him into something. Slavery, and I'm pretty sure that's before America was a nation. Right? Second book of the Bible, Exodus, Moses, Israelites out of slavery. Like, this is crazy. So, in fairness, most Christians don't read the Bible anymore. So let's assume Tim Kaine doesn't know the Bible. Okay, cool. How bad was your world history teacher that you never heard of, like, the Greeks or the Romans? Or, like, what in the world? And yet, this is the honest-to-God's position that kids are hearing in school. America is uniquely evil for having slavery, and we created something evil, and we exported it to the rest of the world. That is how dumb this position is, and yet that's what we're teaching. This is also on their website. This is for teachers saying, hey guys, if you need curriculum, we've got all this curriculum for you. Get it on our website. You can use this to teach history. There are actually states like Minnesota who decided the 1619 Project will be the standard that they use for their history curriculum for their public schools for the next 10 years. That passed in their state legislature last year, signed by the governor. In their state legislature, they said, we will no longer study, and this isn't the law, like I told you last time, don't take my word for this, go look it up. They said, we will no longer study the American Revolution, the Civil War, World War I, World War II, or the Holocaust. Because those are not important for our students to know. Instead, we will teach the 1619 Project. We will teach about systemic racism and white oppression, right? This white power slavery nonsense. And we will make sure our kids learn how bad America has been. That's in their state law, okay? This is exactly where it's coming from. Now, it's also worth noting, when the project came out, a lot of articles, there were a lot of historians who were like, this is bogus. Now, they did receive an award, which is crazy, but a lot of historians came out and they were like, yeah, you messed up on like every detail of history. This is so bad. Even the secular guys identified this as bad. And one of the things I want to point out is on their website, they do offer a correction. So let's give credit where it's due. They do offer a correction. This is the only correction they offered on their website. An earlier version of the introduction of this project incorrectly referred to Virginia in the year 1619 as a British colony. At the time, it was an English colony. I'm glad they clarified that. That was very misleading. What? This is the problem with what we are dealing with. And let me point out, one of the narratives today is that America was monolithic. There's only one beginning to America. America did not only have one early colony. In fact, America more closely resembles this idea from Charles Dickens, A Tale of Two Cities. America had two primary early colonies. It had Jamestown and it had Plymouth. Now, it's worth noting most of the history they're saying about Jamestown is incorrect. And we'll cover that maybe a little bit more later. However, even if you agreed with Jamestown, which you shouldn't because it's mostly incorrect what they're saying, Plymouth was a dichotomy and distinction between the philosophy of Jamestown. Let me quickly remind you, right? Jamestown did not start in 1619. It started in 1607, and some interesting even Christian dynamic there I don't have time to get into, but early leaders, right? Captain John Smith, really incredible leader on a lot of regards, and then you have individuals like Pocahontas, so a lot of stories, a lot of noted people there. Well, then, if you look at Plymouth, who are some of the noted people from Plymouth? Certainly, we have Governor Bradford, but I love the fact, right? When the pilgrims get there, one of the very first people they meet, part of the narrative of their story, is they meet this Native American Somerset who speaks little English. And they're like, this is crazy. He speaks English. And Somerset says, I really don't speak it that well, but there's somebody else you need to meet, right? Introduce them to Squanto. Squanto is the one who literally helped the pilgrims stay alive. Had it not been for Squanto, the pilgrims never would have survived, and had they not survived, America never would have become the America we know today. Well, when Squanto comes, they also come with Chief Massasoit. And along these lines, Chief Massasoit and the pilgrims get along so well, they actually sign a peace treaty. It is the longest-lasting peace treaty between any whites and any Native Americans in the history of America. It lasted more than 50 years, which I'll come back to more of that later. But the narrative from 1619 says, well, this is when a shipload of slaves arrived in Jamestown, and this is where Jamestown was so evil. Let's pause real quick. Don't take my word for this. Look it up. Slavery was illegal in Jamestown in 1619. Well, how did they have slaves then? Oh, they didn't. Let me tell you the story. The slave trade was going full bore at that time. Right? And you had the Muslim slave traders from North Africa, and you had the Dutch and the Portuguese, and you had the Spanish, and so a lot of people were involved in the slave trade. There's money to be made. And at the time, there were some English sailors on a Dutch vessel that was a privateer vessel. These are like pirates, but they're flying under the Dutch flag, so it's kind of legal, but not really, right? There was a Portuguese slave trading ship, and this Dutch vessel, crewed by Englishmen, attacked the Portuguese slave trading ship. Well, the slave trading ship's not a warship. They're quickly overcome by this Dutch vessel, and the Englishmen, they decide, let's take booty off. They end up taking 19 slaves off this Portuguese vessel, and they go, we don't have any place to keep the slaves. What are we going to do? They said, well, let's go sell them in Jamestown. So they go to Jamestown. Again, don't take my word for this. Look it up. They go to Jamestown, and they say, hey, we've got these slaves. We don't really have like the room and the food. We want to go be more pirates. Like, can we just sell them to you? And Jamestown said, well, we don't have slaves. They said, well, what do you have? They said, well, we have indentured servitude. They said, fine, we will sell you indentured servants. They said, well, we can buy indentured servants. This is not just a distinction. It is a distinction with a significant difference. Indentured servitude had a specified period of years. On average, it was 7 years. And in the Jamestown colony, at the end of 7 years, you know what you got? You not only got your freedom, you were given your own parcel of land, between 40 to 250 acres, depending on where you were. The records of Jamestown show not only that they were indentured servants, by 1633, there are actually records that some of the former slaves that arrived in 1619, and like no mistake, they were slaves on a Portuguese slave trading vessel. They just ceased to be slaves when they got to Jamestown. They became indentured servants, and then in 1633, there's records from Jamestown that some of those original slaves not only were free landowners in 1633, but they were indenturing other black servants to come work for them on their farms in 1633. Okay, now let me also give you another, what we would consider a hot take. Had that Portuguese slave trading vessel reached its destination, arguably Cuba, Central or South America, what was the average lifespan for a slave, Cuba, Central, South America? Depending on where they landed, between 1 to 3 years. Had they arrived anywhere but Jamestown, they likely would have died within 1 to 3 years. The very best place they possibly could have gone. was Jamestown, right? And one of the arguments people say is, well, okay, so they were indentured servants, but still they were treated like slaves for 7 years. In fairness, there is no records to indicate how they were or were not treated. Genuinely, there are no records. So maybe they were treated terribly for 7 years, or maybe they were treated really well for 7 years. We don't know. What we know is they worked for a specified period of years, and they got their freedom, then became landowners. And actually, many of those not only became free landowners, they raised their families, and their generation, some of them still exist to this day. Had they gone anywhere else, it would have been different. Now, that's just a side note of Jamestown. But let's still say, okay, Jamestown did have a lot of major issues. I'm not trying to give a full defense of Jamestown. They did some really ridiculous, jacked up, sinful things. Check. Yes, they did. Let me go to Plymouth, though, and let me just show the dichotomy of the difference. In Plymouth, in 1646, this is, it's really more in New England because the ship originally landed in Connecticut, but nonetheless, this is where one of the very first slave trading ships lands in the New England area. And when it lands, it's significant for us to know that in 1641, the New England colonies passed a series of laws that dealt with slavery. And what they said in the series of laws at the very beginning, that slavery is legal under two conditions. This is the first one. Slavery is legal under two conditions. Slavery is legal as a specified period of years for a crime that is agreed to and determined by the jury, etc. So, right, if you serve 20 years in prison, they called that slavery. But they said slavery is legal for a specified period of years for a crime, or if you were captured in a justified war. Justified war was very clear. Back then, they had just war theory. It was a known thought and theory that it was a defensive war. It's not something you wouldn't attack people. You're not kidnapping. You're not taking them to be your slave. But if somebody attacks you, right, and this is two people groups, if a people group attacks your people group and you conquer that people group, then you actually were legally allowed to keep them as slaves. And even today, we're like, well, that's pretty barbaric. In the 1600s, in the era of conquest, there were only two options for the survivors of the defeated group. They either were executed or they were enslaved. Like this is not the pilgrims being weird or evil. Like this, that's just the way it was. However, the second law they passed, more noted, they said that man-stealing is against the law. And they defined man-stealing, similar to what the Bible says in Exodus, is if you kidnap someone, and in their law they said if you kidnap someone and take them from their own land across the Great Sea to a new land and sell them into slavery, that's called man-stealing, it's against the law. Well, that law was passed 1641. 1646, this shipload of slaves arrived in Connecticut, and the people of Connecticut found out, because presumably, right, the captain, the crew, they're like, hey, we got slaves, you need slaves. And they're like, wait a second. Well, they go and they arrest the captain, they arrested the crew, they took them to court, and they charged them with the crime of man-stealing. Not only that, they then took up a collection, and interesting, I would call it a tax, because it was a mandatory donation. It's your generosity that I'm forcing upon you. They took a mandatory donation, and they used the money, and they hired a new captain, a new crew, and a new ship, and they said, take them back to wherever they want to go, get them back home. The pilgrims literally enslaved their captors, and they actually freed and paid for those slaves to be returned. This is the dichotomy that today people don't understand. At the end of the Civil War, this is a really brilliant map. The end of the Civil War, where we have the era of Reconstruction, this was done after, like, kind of the end of Reconstruction. And over on the right, there's two primary colonies. You see Jamestown is over here. Plymouth is up here. Well, Jamestown, there's high-res images online. You can go look online and see this. It's easier to see it when you're close. But right here where the Jamestown ship is, right there on the side, it's a coin, but it says Mammon. Up here, that's a book that says Bible. They point out that Jamestown got so caught up in money, right, and greed, and wealth, and their lust got the better of them. And so, if you actually get close, you can get a higher res image of this and see, but it shows things like the Dred Scott decision, the Fugitive Slave Law, the Kansas-Nebraska Act, and it shows all of the pro-slavery things that came because people were more interested in making their dollar than they were in what was right. But for the pilgrims, from the pilgrims came things like intelligence and obedience to law and equal rights and love of country and philanthropy and benevolence and happiness, and on it goes. I want to point out, the legacy of the, and this map I think is correct, the legacy of the pilgrims impacted far more of America than the legacy of Jamestown, because even when people talk about, well, America was so Jim Crow law, slavery, and all this, let's just keep in mind, who had Jim Crow laws? It was the deep Democratic South. You understand? Montana didn't have Jim Crow laws. Oregon didn't have Jim Crow laws. Colorado didn't have Jim Crow laws. California didn't have Jim Crow laws. So when people today, well, all America's racist, we're not all guilty of the sins somebody else did, right? Like, our state never did any of that. You're crazy. However, this is where today what our kids are learning is something so ridiculous. And let's keep in mind, the 1619 Project, I said we're going to come back to this. The 1619 Project said we want to highlight the contributions of black Americans. What black Americans are you highlighting? Because I would like to offer a few suggestions. If you back up to the early 1800s, there are guys like the Reverend Harry Hoosier. The Reverend Harry Hoosier was a slave, and worth noting, from the founding era, when we separate from Great Britain, almost every single northern colony began passing anti-slavery laws. And this was a movement where the vast majority of founding fathers come out against slavery. So many people end up freeing their slaves. He got freed during the American Revolution. So he was a slave. He got his freedom. Well, once he had his freedom, there was a famous Methodist minister named Francis Asbury. Francis Asbury is traveling. He's preaching. And Harry Hoosier hears him. Man, he's so impressed. Harry Hoosier wants to help him. Harry Hoosier ends up driving his carriage. And as he's driving, he listens to the Reverend Francis Asbury read the Bible. And he says, hey, would you read it out loud? And Francis Asbury starts reading it out loud. And Harry Hoosier begins memorizing the Bible, entire chapters and then entire books of the Bible, as Francis Asbury read it out loud. He said, this is pretty amazing. Francis Asbury, as he's traveling, Harry Hoosier says, I want to do what you do. I want to be a preacher. And he says, okay, next time I do one of these crusades, when I'm finished, you can come up and you can preach. And you know what? A lot of times when we're in the South and different, some of these states, even in the middle and some of these northern states, there's still some slaves around. And so when we're there, if especially they're slaves, like they would be so encouraged to hear the gospel from another black person. And so let's do that. So at the end of Francis Asbury, he puts Harry Hoosier up there. Harry Hoosier begins speaking, and he talked about the parable of the fig tree. But it was so good that all the white people came back, because they hadn't left yet. And they came back, and people began to talk about how good this guy was. One of the founding fathers, Benjamin Rush, really important founding father, he said he'd never heard a better speaker his entire life. He knew every founding father. He knew Patrick Henry, right? Like, he knew all these guys. Never heard a better speaker. Well, Harry Hoosier became so popular that Francis Asbury actually asked Harry Hoosier to keep traveling with him. This is actually in Francis Asbury's records. Francis said, I asked Harry to keep traveling with me because I would always get larger crowds if he was there than if he wasn't. Okay? Well, Harry Hoosier felt that God had called him, and this is what even Francis Asbury said, but Harry Hoosier said he felt God had called him to reach the people that were a little rougher around the edges, right? Like your outdoorsmen, your frontiersmen, the people that are working with the sweat of their brow and their hands in their back. And interestingly enough, where he was preaching over on the east, well, at this time in America, America is expanding and there's new territories. And one of the new territories where a lot of people were going was the Indiana Territory. Well, the Indiana Territory, right? In fact, when they became a state, they literally are called the Hoosiers. Where in the world did they get the name Hoosier? Let me also point out, if you look this up on the Indiana State website, and I think they're being honest on this part of the question, then they're dishonest or dumb on some of the other parts, but in this part, they say, we actually don't know where the name came from. Well, that's fair, because like it's not in a written document. We are called Hoosiers because of this. That's true. However, they say there are multiple suggestions people offer why we're called Hoosier. One, it's possible back then they had accents that were kind of different, and so somebody knocks on the door, and they said, who's there? But it sounded like Hoosier, so that's one possibility. Second possibility, there's an Indian word for corn named hosey, and maybe like there was a derivative like hosier. Like maybe it came from the Indian word for corn. They said third option, when Indiana was still a territory, there was a very, like 1810, there was a very famous drunken brawl, and apparently, legend has it, during this brawl, as there, people are fighting, somebody's ear got ripped off. So at the end of the fight, somebody, right? Who's here? Who's here? The fourth option, they say there was a black minister. He's more commonly known in that era as Black Harry, but his name was Harry Hoosier, and we know he was very influential on many of the settlers that were coming to the Indiana Territory, so it's possible the name came because of his influence on all the settlers that were coming to the territory. But we don't actually know. So in fairness, maybe they don't know. I'm going to say there's only one that makes very much sense, right? It's the ear. That's the only one that makes... No. It's not. That's just funny to me, right? But let me point out, okay? A state is literally named after a black man in the 1619 Project. I'm going to talk about this guy. Or we could talk about the very first black American to successfully evangelize Native Americans. He actually was a free black man, and he converted to Christianity under George Whitefield, and he became so sold out, he wanted to follow Jesus and just serve God, and he talked about faith all the time, so much so, his family wasn't Christian, and they began to get annoyed with it. They're like, dude, that's too much Jesus, you need to settle down. He said, and this is in his own writings, he said, they began to call me every name except one which was good, and I found no relief except out in the woods by myself. So he would go spend his time in the woods, and he was 13 years old. He said he decided, as a 13-year-old, it would be better for him just to go live in the woods. And he didn't know how to live in the woods. He said, it'd be better for me to live in the woods, and I'll stay out there, I'll starve to death, but it's okay, because once I die, I'm going to be with Jesus. So he decides he's going to go to the woods and starve to death. Well, while he's in the woods, he's walking around, presumably praying, singing a song, right, being spiritual, and a Native American comes up to him. It's Cherokee. And the Cherokee comes up and says, hey, what are you doing? And the Cherokee actually had done some trading in the town where John Morant was from, and he knew him, and he said, what are you doing out here? Do you need me to take you home? And he said, I'm not going home. I'm not accepted. I'm just going to stay out here. And the Cherokee says, okay, you're crazy. Come stay with me. Well, the Cherokee was out gathering furs. And so this was a normal time for him. He would go and spend 8 and 10 weeks at a time. This time of year, he would gather furs. He was hunting. He was fishing. So he starts teaching John how to live off the land. Well, he also begins conversing with John, and they're speaking in English. He's teaching John Cherokee. Well, at the end of this 8 or 10 weeks, the Cherokee decides he's going to go back to his tribe. He takes John with him, and he says, look, you don't want to go home. Come live with me. It's going to be fine. I'll take care of you. Well, they go back. The problem is when they got to the tribe, the chief had a standing order that no outsiders were allowed, and it was very clear that John Morant was not a Cherokee. And so the chief ordered him to be executed. So John said that they told me they were going to execute me the next morning. They were going to put me in this little pen for the night. And he says they took me by the place they were going to execute me in the morning, and they began to show me the devices they were going to use to kill me. And they were going to torture him to death. So they explained, like, they were going to strip him naked, and they were going to stake him out. And then, I'm not going to be graphic because there's kids in the room, but like, he goes through, in his records, he goes through all the things they said they're going to do. And so they took him, they put him in this little pen. He was locked in there, and he said at first, and it was covered. So he couldn't see anything. They couldn't see into him. But he was terrified, and at first, he didn't know what to do. He had his Bible with him, he said, but then he realized that even though it's going to be really awful when they kill me tomorrow, he says, but once I die, I get to be with Jesus. So he begins to have like this Paul and Silas moment in prison. He starts singing songs. He's praising God. And one of the guards comes over and opens up and looks and says, who are you talking to? And he said, I'm talking to Jesus. And he said, the guard looked and said, there's no one here. He said, oh, Jesus is with us right now. And he began telling the guard about Jesus. The guard was so impressed. He said, I'm going to be right back. He went and got some of the elders from the tribe. They came. He said, tell them about Jesus. Told the elders about Jesus. They said, the chief needs to hear this. He took him. He ends up talking to the chief. The chief ends up converting to Christianity. The entire tribe ends up converting to Christianity. The chief not only frees him, he gives him this huge lanyard and made him a prince of the tribe. He said, if you wear this, you can go to all of our villages, all of our people. Like, this is your free pass. Like, you will always be protected. And the chief said, will you stay with us and teach us more about Jesus from this holy book you have? So John literally lives with them. Well, then the chief says, you know, there's some other tribes around that are not our tribe, but they need to hear this too. Would you be willing to go witness these other tribes? And John says, sure, I'll go to other tribes. And the chief said, now, just so you know, these tribes, they're warring tribes and they're fierce warriors. And probably like us, they won't accept you right at first. And so we want to make sure you're okay. And John says, so the chief determined to send me with his personal guard. His personal guard were the 50 bravest warriors of the tribe. Okay? I've done several mission trips in my life. I just want to tell you, like, If somebody was like, hey, Tim, we need you to go on a mission trip. We're sending 50 Navy SEALs with you. Like, I'm in. I don't know where I'm going. I want to be part of this. It sounds so awesome, right? Yes. He literally starts off, first of all, with the Cherokee tribe, but then he goes and spends time in the Catasar tribe. Then he goes to the Husal tribe. Then he goes to the Creeks. He spends a year and a half living with the Indians as a missionary. He finally ends up going home, and his entire account, it was the narrative of the Lord's wonderful dealings with John Morant, a black, and it says when he was 14 years old, is because he turned 14 when he was out in the woods. So he was 14 when he got back. This was the most successful and best-selling narrative of a black American in early American history. Like, almost everybody knew who this guy was. This is the first black American to successfully evangelize Native Americans, but he doesn't really fit the parameters of what 1619 is looking for, right? You could talk about, this is a guy, he was the very first black man to be ordained in America. And some people look at the painting, or that lithograph, and they're like, he didn't look very black. His father was a black man, his mother was a white woman. However, in the era where they said one drop of blood, right? Like, I mean, literally, like that's President Obama, right? Had a black and white parent on different sides. Nonetheless, he is considered the first black man to receive a degree of higher education. He ends up becoming a pastor. This is a painting of him as a pastor, and it's very clear, right? That's a black man in the pulpit. Look at the congregation. He was the pastor of a white church. So explain to me how racist America is. Because I'm pretty sure, like, in fairness, I'm not really good at the racist stuff, right? So I don't know, but I feel like if you were a racist and you're a white person, you probably don't want a black person as your pastor, right? Like, I'm just guessing, but I feel like that's probably accurate. This is what's crazy, is we can go through genuinely nearly countless examples, and in the midst of this, we actually have some of his early sermons. He was the first black man to have published sermons in America. Again, very notable guy. He also served in the American Revolution. He was one of the Massachusetts Minutemen. There were black ones? Yep, there was a black, at least one, we know. Lemuel Haynes was. However, he also serves under George Washington in the Revolution as pastor. He actually preached sermons where he talked about the Christian faith of George Washington. We have some of his Bibles with actually his signature in the front. Like, really, really cool. We keep going, though, because if you look at the American Revolution, when the American Revolution unfolds, April 1775, this is when you have Paul Revere making his famous midnight ride. Well, also worth noting, when Paul Revere rides, even that night, he wasn't the only guy to ride to make a famous midnight ride. Right? You have William Dawes, you had other people. But every time the British go to a new town, there were Americans riding to warn other Americans the British were coming. One of the individuals who made a famous midnight ride was Wentworth Cheswell. Wentworth Cheswell was a black patriot, and not only was he a black patriot, he also was a black politician, elected official. We actually have some of his original documents signed, Wentworth Cheswell, right? But here's what's interesting about him. Wentworth Cheswell was first elected in 1768, and then for the next 49 years, he served in public office in a variety of positions. Now, it is worth noting that we did have a black man elected for 49 years in a row. What's more notable is he lived in a white community. So he's literally being elected by white people, right? Like, it's kind of a big deal, but let me back up. Paul Revere, right? April 18th, 1775, makes his famous midnight ride. He's riding specifically to warn John Hancock and Sam Adams, hey, the British have orders. They want to seize your bodies. They're coming to take our military supplies from Lexington and Concord, but you guys have to get out of here. Well, where does Paul Revere go to warn them? He rode to the church of the Reverend Jonas Clark, because Jonas Clark was a cousin to John Hancock, but he was known to be a friend and mentor of other founding fathers. When the British show up the next morning on Lexington Green, there were 73 Americans against more than 700 British. Where did the 73 Americans come from? They were all from the church of the Reverend Jonas Clark. And among them, you had people like John Robbins, a white guy, and Prince Esterbrook, a black guy. Two of the individuals who were shot that day, there were 18 individuals shot on the American side. Well, Prince Esterbrook, now again, all from the church of Jonas Clark, which means they had white and black guys going to church together back then. But Prince Esterbrook, even back then, they had statues and monuments erected to him back then. Well, even now today, they have newer stuff at Lexington Green to honor who he was and what he did. Well, then just go a month so later, 1775, this is when you have the Battle of Bunker Hill. This is about 6 weeks later. But the Battle of Bunker Hill, this is a very famous painting. Over on the right, it's a little hard to see this painting because this specific painting was done talking about the death of this individual right here, but it included several notable people in this painting along the way, including the Bridges, Major Pitcairn right there. But over on the right side is a guy named Peter Salem. He's standing behind a white guy, Thomas Grosvenor. Peter Salem became known as the hero of the Battle of Bunker Hill. And other lithographs actually do a better job of like highlighting, like very clearly, that's a black man in this lithograph, and he's holding a rifle. Well, the reason he was the hero of the battle, if you remember the Battle of Bunker Hill, when the British were in town, it's kind of ironic and funny, the British officer said, hey guys, we should set up a perimeter around the city. And they said, but it's late tonight, let's do it in the morning. Well, that night the Americans came in, they took the high ground. The British wake up the next morning, they're like, dang it, they have the high ground, okay. We got to take the hill. So this is the charge of Breed's Hill, the Battle of Bunker Hill. So they charge up the hill. Well, the Americans are outnumbered, but they have a better position. And so the first charge, they repel the British the first charge. Second charge, well, the British regroup, they charge a second time. They repel them a second time. And at this point, the British called in the Royal Marines. Over, I think it was like 100 Royal, maybe it's only 70, but a number of Royal Marines. And the Royal Marines are like the British version of the Navy SEALs, right? The Green Berets, the Forest Recon Marines. These are your special force guys. They said, we need the hill, and they said, we're taking the hill. Well, as they're running up the hill, the Americans ran out of ammunition. At this point, they have been just obliterating the British. Well, if you don't have bullets, it's going to be very hard to win this attack. As the Americans call retreat because they're out of ammunition, they're being overwhelmed by the British, but the commanding officer leading the charge was Major Pitcairn. There was one American who had one shot left. It was Peter Salem. He up with his musket. He shot the commanding officer. When Major Pitcairn fell, like this was like Hercules getting shot in battle. Like, oh, this is our guy, right? This is crazy. It actually stopped the charge because they were so shocked. It gave the Americans just enough time to escape, to live to fight another day. And they said, this dude saved all of our lives. And if he hadn't shot that guy, there were a dozen officers. Actually, I think it was 13 officers who wrote a commendation encouraging his promotion. Well, he fought in multiple battles, and even there, he wasn't the only noted black guy because there was another black man, Salem Moore, who was noted as being one of the bravest soldiers on the front lines of the charge. I can go through the entire revolution pointing out black heroes along the way, but let me jump to the very end just to make this point as we're gonna try to start wrapping things up for the evening. 1781, this is the last major battle of the American Revolution. The last major battle, one of the leaders who was there was the Marquis de Lafayette. And Lafayette, when he comes to America, is only 19 years old, becomes very good friends with Washington. They served through the Revolution. But Washington charged him that you need to track the movements of the British officers. Specifically, I need you to track the movements of Lord Cornwallis, the commander of all the British forces. If we know where he goes, if we can bottle him up, if we can capture him, then we can just end this war outright. Well, Lafayette decides the best way to do this is he needs to form a spy ring. Now, some people know about like the Cooper spy ring. There were multiple spy rings. In fact, Abigail Adams led an all-female spy ring. Like, there were some cool stories, but there were lots of spy rings. He led a spy ring. What's amazing about his spy ring is it was made up primarily of black patriots. And the reason Lafayette said is because what we can do with these black patriots is they can pretend to be escaped slaves, escaping from the American side, seeking refuge in the British. The British will welcome them in, and then they can listen in the camp and try to gather plans and details, come back and report to us, and we'll know what's going on. The most famous spy, literally in the American Revolution, arguably most successful, was a black man named James Armistead. Now, James Armistead, part of his story, if you remember the famous American traitor, Benedict Arnold, when he sells out Washington, or tries to, it's the fall of 1780. Well, he goes to the British side, they make him a British general. In January of 1781, he led the British troops against Richmond, Virginia. As they attack Richmond, Virginia, Richmond falls. Well, James Armistead was in Richmond, Virginia. And when the British take over Richmond, they're doing a lot of really bad things. They're killing a lot of people. They're burning a lot of places down. And James Armistead saw this. And he said, this is terrible. He said, I want to sign up to go fight against the British. And at the time, the laws of Virginia said, if you fight for 1 year, you could have your freedom. His master knew it. He told his master, I want to fight. He said, that's fine. You can go fight. So James goes and signs up to fight. When he goes to sign up, Lafayette sees him and says, hey, actually, you're perfect. Because the British have this huge camp in Richmond now. You can go to Richmond, pretend to be an escaped slave, right, local farm, you're seeking refuge, gather the intel, and come back to me. So James starts serving in the British camp in Richmond, but he does such a good job serving, the commander of the British camp in Richmond, Benedict Arnold, saw him and decided a guy who serves that well shouldn't just serve the common man. So he made James his personal assistant. And James, irony, James was called to serve in the officer's tent. Well, at this point, Benedict Arnold got recalled or reassigned to go serve in the camp of Lord Cornwallis, the commander of all the British forces, and Arnold says, well, I'm going to take my personal assistant. Literally, James went with Benedict Arnold into the camp of Lord Cornwallis and went to all of the officers' meetings, and so he began hearing all the plans of the British, of what they're doing and where they're going, and he gets word back to Lafayette. Literally, he's the guy, and there's two really cool letters from Lafayette that even tell this story. One, in I think it's like February 1781, Lafayette writes to Washington and says that we have a new spy in the British camp, and he's proving to be the best spy of all the spies I have. He's giving me better intel than anybody else. I'm very excited what he might find for us. And to this point, you're like, well, how do we know who that is? Second letter reveals. Because the second letter, Lafayette writes Washington and says, hey, remember that spy I told you about, the best spy we have? He's now in Cornwallis' camp. And he has just informed us that Cornwallis is moving with several thousand men, and they're going to Yorktown. And if they get to Yorktown, the French fleet's on the way. If the French fleet can bottle up from right the ocean, and we can come and bottle the other side, this might be the very moment we've been waiting and praying for. If we can capture him, we might can end the war. Well, that's what Washington does. They go, they put a siege on Yorktown, right? And there's some providence involved because a storm blows the British Navy out. It blows the French Navy in. But they end up getting Cornwallis to surrender. Interestingly enough, Washington and even Lafayette both point out the reason they were able to do that was because the intelligence they got from the most famous spy in American history. Now, literally the American Revolution was won because of the intelligence of a black soldier, but I'm going to go even further. In 1818, John Adams was writing to Thomas Jefferson, and he said, if you look back at the Revolution, and maybe it's 1816, but it's somewhere around there. He said, if you look at the American Revolution, he said, the more significant moments, he said, it wasn't when the shot happened at Lexington Green or the Battle of Concord Bridge. He said, it wasn't even the Battle of Saratoga. It wasn't even the victory at Yorktown. He said, the most significant moment of the Revolution actually was when the first blood was shed at King Street. He said, because that's when the Revolution actually began. Well, King Street was the Boston Massacre. Who was the first person killed in the Boston Massacre? A black man named Crispus Attucks. I would point out, even from the Founding Fathers' own writings, the Revolution began with the death of a black patriot, and the Revolution was won because of the contributions of a black patriot. You can't even tell the honest story of the American Revolution without including the contributions of the incredible black patriots, and the 1619 Project mentions none of them because it doesn't fit the narrative of the Marxist oppression ideals. Right? This is not the story we want kids to know now. Again, why don't we know this today? Well, one of the primary reasons is you can go back in the progressive era when they took over and literally begin rewriting education. Now, Woodrow Wilson is the guy who I would primarily blame for this, but in 1902, just to walk you through the story, in 1902, Woodrow Wilson wrote a five-volume set called The History of the American People. And this five-volume set, at this time he was a president, a professor at two different universities, but mostly at Princeton. He then became the first president of Yale University, who was not a pastor, also interesting. And then he became a governor, and then he became the president. And it was all based on the praise he had started receiving for this book. So this book ultimately leads to him getting to the White House. Well, when he gets to the White House, several interesting things happen. He starts to resegregate America. Now, why resegregate? Because at the end of the Civil War, in the Reconstruction era, right? A lot of that had changed. In fact, there wasn't a black military, a white military. There was one military, the Union military, and it was an integrated military. When he takes over, he says, nope, we're segregating again. He showed the very first ever film in the White House. It was The Birth of a Nation. He gave it two viewings. The Birth of a Nation was a recruiting film for the KKK. Now, The Birth of a Nation was written based on the novel Birth of a Nation. That's where the movie came from. But the novel Birth of a Nation, the author said he was inspired to write this book after reading Woodrow Wilson's five-volume set of American history. Woodrow Wilson, under his leadership, they had the rebirth of the KKK, actually had open marches in Washington, D.C., and it was reported his own administration was openly marching with the KKK in Washington, D.C. I'm pointing this out, he was an incredible racist guy, and that's even apparent in his history book. In his history book, there is not one five-volume set, came out in 1902, there's not one single mention of a black person, not one. Now, it's worth noting, at this point, Frederick Douglass, incredibly famous American. Frederick Douglass was photographed more times than Abraham Lincoln. Also, Booker T. Washington, incredibly famous. George Washington Carver, incredibly famous. Like, literally, we can go through, like, incredibly famous people, and even popular at that time, he didn't include any of them. But he did include actually some images of black people, because he said black people do exist, but he held a very racist position. And when he showed that black people did exist, what he showed was very racist imagery. And the imagery he showed is kind of interesting to me, because the imagery is a little bit on the scale of this Neanderthal idea, right? From the goo to you, and it's the Neanderthal, the evolution along the way. Well, where did Woodrow Wilson come up with this idea? He was just following the science, guys. Just trust the science. Charles Darwin, right? The noted outspoken scientist at the time, he had written a book prior called The Origin of Species, except it wasn't just called The Origin of Species. It was The Origin of Species by Means of Natural Selection, or, notice, I'm going to enlarge so you can see it, The Preservation of Favored Races in the Struggle for Life. Favored races? Yeah, Darwin was an incredible racist too. Literally, Woodrow Wilson took the ideas that Darwin had been promoting, and he removed every single black hero from American history. And so today, right, people think, well, only white people oppress black people. I tell you the whole history of America. There is so much more to the story. I don't have time to get into all of it tonight. Let me give you a little bit for the last couple minutes. For the 1619 Project, their argument, right, is that, well, America was built on slavery, and there have been dozens, if not hundreds, of articles over the last couple of years that talk about how this is the foundation of philosophy of America. I want to point out that if you look historically, first of all, America was not ever a world leader in the global slave trade. This is important, because if you want to take more effort to do it all, there are records. Actually, going back to the African slave trade, which to walk you through it, African slave trade goes from roughly 1501 to 1875. There's approximately 12.7 million slaves taken out of Africa. This is a map actually identifying where many of those slaves went, and there's actually records from the slave ships that were there. They actually have the records from who was on the ship, who was the captain, how many slaves, where they delivered, etc. What's worth noting is when they go through the list of this, and this was done by a group of scholarly professors, not Christians, not right conservative, just honest professors. What they identified is in the African slave trade, 43% of the slaves went to Portugal and Brazil, 24% went to Great Britain, 15% went to Spain, 11% went to France, 5% went to the Dutch, 3.1% went to North America, and 1% went to Denmark. Okay, so what this does mean, America clearly participated in the evil of the global slave trade. But America's nowhere near a leader, and also that 3.1%, in America, there were more than just English colonies in North America. You had French colonies and Spanish colonies, and they got the vast majority of that 3.1%. Very few of that number actually came to English colonies in America. And let me go even further. Because slavery was a global condition, all nations had slavery, and yet in the midst of all nations having slavery, do you know that actually if you look specifically to the founding fathers in America, we had the first major region in the world to enact bans on slavery. By 1804, every single northern colony in America had banned slavery. New Jersey was the last state, 1804, that's when they did their ban on slavery. And so at that point, then every single northern state had banned slavery. England didn't ban slavery until 1833. We had a bigger landmass and population in that area of North America than England did, and we beat them by 30 years. And nobody talks about it. But people argue, yeah, but we didn't really end slavery. Okay, let's go to what we really did end. Because in 1807, we were the first nation in the world to sign a law banning the slave trade. Thomas Jefferson signed that law on March 2nd, 1807. And people argue, in fact, you look it up today, it's just stupid. You look it up today, and England is credited as being the first nation banning slavery. England signed the law on March 25th, 1807, and people say, but England's law went into effect right then. America's law didn't go into effect until January 1st, 1808, because in the Constitution, it says no law can be passed banning the importation of individuals prior to the year 1808, because that was a compromise that abolitionist founding fathers made with pro-slavery founding fathers that we won't end it till 20 years, but 1808 it ends. Jefferson actually goes and lobbies Congress in 1806. They actually drafted 1807. March 2nd, he signs a law. But here's what's worth noting. England enacted their law first, but read England's law. It said that they allowed up until March of 1808 for ships to fulfill all of their contracts. America said January 1st, 1808, you're done. Not only did we sign it first, we totally banned it first. America's not even mentioned as one of the nations leading this war against the slave trade. And even interestingly enough, at the end of the War of 1812, we kept a squadron of Navy ships off the coast of Africa to stop slave ships. This was actually part of the negotiation ending the War of 1812. When we signed the peace treaty, it's actually in the peace treaty that we and England would work together and we would keep our navies off of the coast of Africa to try to stop the slave trade together. England and America had squadrons working literally together, and we had our Navy there up until the Civil War starts, and then our Navy was called home by Abraham Lincoln because we had to deal with a local conflict. But the reason I'm pointing this out, right? America also, we were the fourth nation in the world to ban slavery in 1865. Only three nations beat us. England, Denmark, France. We were the fourth major nation in the world, and today it's like people don't even realize slavery still exists. Here's where I want to conclude because I am out of time. I want to finish by pointing out, if you look at America, America's not a perfect nation, but let me walk you through this. America did start legal opposition to slavery before any other nation in the world. America paid a higher price in ending slavery than any other nation in the world. We're the only nation where white people fought a war against other white people, and at the end of that war, they freed all the black people. Only nation in the world. We also do more to oppose slavery today than virtually any other nation in the world. Slavery still exists today. At the UN, there's 193 member nations. A report came out in 2021, 94 nations that are part of the UN still have not passed laws to ban slavery. Slavery happens all over the world, and we are actually the world leaders right now opposing the global slave trade. We started earlier, paid a higher price, and we do more today, and even beyond that, America could not have become America without the contribution of the black patriots, and there are hundreds more examples I could give you. The reality is our nation's history is not as dark and dirty as a lot of people say. It's just we don't know that anymore. Again, this is a lot of why we do what we do. I'd encourage you, if you want to know more of this story, this is stuff included in our book, The American Story. We have lots of other resources as well, but we're going to go through a lot more of this tomorrow. Guys, we're just getting started. I've said a lot. I have a lot more to say. Please come back tomorrow morning.